This is the Medicast, March 9th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's very special episode. We're really excited. We've got a lot going on this week, so we're going to move right on into stuff. But before I do that, I want to especially extend a welcome to all the brand new listeners to the show. There's a lot of new listeners, as the rest of you out there are sharing the Medicast with everybody you know. And that's a great thing because it makes sure this community continues to grow and support itself and make sure that everybody is sharing the best possible EMS news, commentary, and information possible here at the Medicast. If you haven't already done so, you'll definitely want to head over and check out the Medicast blog. And you can go to medicast.com and click the link there for the Medicast show notes blog, or you can just go directly to medicast.com/blog. While you're there, you'll find links to everything we talk about in this and every other episode in the show notes for each episode, and that's in the podcast category. You'll find links to that in the left-hand column there. You can also check out links to other important category ideas there in the blog as well. Listen to the show and sign up for the Medicast newsletter, all available for you at medicast.com/blog. Time to look at some listener email, and I've been corresponding with listeners Woody and David this week. They're going to be joining us this coming Tuesday night on the Medicast Live. We'll be talking about collegiate EMS, and we've been talking about some of the issues that have been faced by collegiate EMS responders. Most of these units are first responder units. They don't transport patients, but they provide initial care until area jurisdictional ambulance services can arrive from outside of the campus. And they were talking about some of the issues that are faced commonly by providers inside of campuses because of some preconceived notions. And we've talked about some of these preconceived notions issues before regarding other providers. Listener Renee brought up a concern about event providers, special event providers that come in and work just for community events that happen in your area. And they don't handle transport. They provide on-site care and turnover patient care. But there are sometimes problems. They are seen as not real providers or not treated appropriately because they aren't part of the local services. You know, we need to work together and transfer care and work as professionals. And, you know, we need to respect providers on scene as the people that are going to be transferring care to us. They have valuable information to provide. They've provided interventions for these patients, and we need to be open-minded about what they do. And this goes whether it's a college EMT who's volunteering in his college campus community or an event provider who's coming in and working for a specific event and is only in town for a weekend. They all deserve our respect as medical professionals, and heck, they've gone through the same process we've gone through to get to where they are, and certainly deserve our respect for that, if for nothing else. So let's remember to treat each other well, turn over care, and listen attentively to what's going on with the providers that we encounter in the field. I also got a great email in from our good friend Irk from the Irk Pod podcast. Irk is an Australian podcaster. He's also a fire dispatcher in his region. We've had him on the show before to talk a little bit about their system down there. Well, guess what? Irk is coming to the U.S. That's right. We are going to have the Irk invasion coming up here in about a month or so. He's going to be flying into the West Coast, and he's actually going to be driving around the U.S. for a month, month and a half or so. And it's really exciting. We're hoping to have him in our area mid to late May, And I'm really excited about that. So maybe we'll have him here on a recording of the Medicast. And definitely I'm looking forward to showing him around the stations here in our region. And I'm hoping to get him in to get a little bit of a tour of our dispatch center. I think that would be something really cool. So anyway, I wanted to just thank Irk for sending out that great email. And, you know, if you are interested in finding out more about what Irk's doing in his upcoming trip, you might want to check out his podcast. You can go to IrkPod, ERKPod.com. He also, I think, can go directly to ChannelIrk.com. So you can check out all of his podcasts. And if you want to see if he's going to be in your region and maybe show off some of your facilities and some of your resources, I'm sure he would love to be able to do that if he's going to be close by. So you can always check in directly with him. And Irk, I'm looking forward to having you here on the Medicast and having you over to the Medicast recording castle here, such as it is. So when you're heading down 95 from New York State, we'll definitely have to have you veer off the path and come in here and visit us. So looking forward to that. And again, everybody can check out more about his upcoming trip and Irk's podcast at IrkPod, ERKPod.com. Well, it's been a bit of a slow email week, and that's okay because sometimes I get so many emails that I feel like all I do is return emails, and I do return every email. So you want to make sure you get in touch with me directly. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Check out the great resources here and call in and let me know what you're doing, whether it's passing a recent exam and getting your certification squared away, or maybe you have a question about something you're working on, whether you've been a provider for a long time or a student provider. Whatever it is, please make sure you check in here and get in touch with me, and I will get back to you as quickly as I can and let you know what my response is, and maybe we'll be able to share that with the listeners as well on the show. Time for our link of the week, and our link of the week this week is going to be for the Medicast Live coming up this Tuesday night, March 10th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and this is medicastlive.com is your resource link for that over at the talkshoe.com site. And this is how we're going to be setting up our show this month. And we're going to be talking about college-based EMS services. So if you have a college in your community and you want to know about whether it's something they would be interested in setting up, or maybe you already know of a college EMS service in your area, it will be a nice opportunity to talk about some of the challenges experienced by them, challenges experienced by you as a local jurisdiction organization, or just to learn about what's going on in collegiate EMS. You know, just like any other community of people, there are volunteer services and organizations out there that are attempting to provide first response, first aid services, and other high-quality medical information and medical treatment for that community. And while most of them are first response units and not necessarily transport services, they still provide a valuable service to that community and surrounding communities in many cases. So we'll be talking about that this coming week. We've got some very special guests coming on. I'm excited to talk more about that this coming Tuesday night, March 10th, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you there as well. Time for our first little look at the news for today, and I'm going to lead off with a story that I found about a Midwest high school-aged EMT who has kind of stepped up and gotten more involved in her community. Tabitha Brown is somebody who doesn't really like to get involved in a lot of things and doesn't like to really try out for a lot of things, but when she learned more about volunteering in her local fire department last year, she decided this was something that really appealed to her. And she became involved at just another whole level, really uncharacteristic for her. You know, she quotes in this article that I found, she's quoted as saying, quote, "Knowing you're helping someone who is in real trouble is such a great feeling, especially when you work together as a team and everything works out," end quote. And, you know, that's exactly why a lot of us do what we do. I know we have a lot of listeners out there who are either prospective EMS providers, they're in school or they're getting ready to join their local organizations, either at a volunteer or at a paid level. And this is something we all need to really support in our communities, to help encourage young kids to get involved in their communities as first responders, to even just train as basic CPR providers and first aid providers. These are all things we can get involved with. So get out to your local high school and teach them about some of the resources available for them in the community. You know, you're getting tired of running into kids who are overdosing or who are out there doing things that are stupid because they're just out on the streets with nothing to do. Well, why don't you help to provide them something to do? And having an active program that engages kids to learn and help serve their communities is just one way to help keep kids off the streets, except unless they're riding with us, right? So, you know, this is something that is, I think, a very valuable tool. And this article clearly outlines that. Here was a student who wasn't interested in being involved in the community, who wasn't interested in getting out and doing anything extracurricular. And yet, when the opportunity presented itself, she became actively involved as an EMT and working hard in her community. And I think that that's just an indication that sometimes you just don't know what kind of response you're going to get. You can't just assume that kids aren't going to be interested. And some of them might be really interested and then lose interest quickly, but others are going to stick and become valuable leaders and providers in the EMS community. Moving right along, let's talk a little bit about the effects of healthcare facility closings. And this is something that we've dealt with here in the United States, and it's far reaching than that. There are hospitals that are threatening to close down either completely or close down their emergency departments in Canada and other places around the world as well. And this has far-reaching effects on the community. One of these issues is outlined in an article I found from Ontario, the Chatham Daily News. And Chatham, Ontario is dealing with the potential issue of having their local emergency department shut down, Wallaceburg Emergency Department. If it did close down, that area would have a significant increased cost of providing emergency care. Ambulance transport costs would increase. Additional costs could approach $2.7 million, according to one area official. And this would cover additional cost of wages, vehicles, and other expenses associated with additional transport times, having to have additional coverage while ambulances were involved in longer transports, and the additional costs of just transporting. These are all things that are an additional cost when hospitals have to close their doors or close their emergency departments for whatever reason. And it has a significant effect on that community. And it's something I think that we need to keep in mind and work with our local emergency departments to find out exactly how we can assist them to remain open, to deal with perhaps overcrowding issues, to make them more profitable to the hospitals. I know most hospitals, we aren't supposed to be operating for profit, but we do need to at least stay in the green or the black, depending on how you do your accounting. One of those things is to just work hard on dealing with getting patients treated in such a way that they can get the care they need without accruing huge emergency department costs. And that could be through urgent care facilities, through additional provision of access to primary care resources, whether it's a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, somebody that can provide some basic non-urgent care to these patients and give them the resources that they need so that the emergency department remains there for what it is for, and that is for treating emergency patients that don't have access to resources in an emergency. And whether that's brought in by ambulance or whether they come in themselves, there are true emergencies that need to be treated. And when that hospital isn't there, those emergencies go untreated for a longer period of time or require additional longer transport times to the facility that they will need to get to for definitive care. So this is something that is, I think, a continuing issue. And it's interesting that it's not just a problem here in the States. It's a continuing issue in other parts of the world as well, as evidenced by this article from Ontario, Canada. While we're on an international track here, let's go ahead and move over to the UK, where I found an article about the aftermath of the response to a teenager who jumped from the back of a moving ambulance in traffic and died as a result of that. And this has happened in the United States. We've talked about it here on the show in the past. We've talked about how in the States here, there are lawsuits from the family involving improper care for the patient. When you have a single provider in the back of the ambulance, you know, how are you supposed to stop somebody from jumping out of the back of the ambulance? If somebody decides to do it, something like that, they're going to do it. And we all know that. But this is not something that just happens here. It happens in a lot of places. And interestingly enough, the issues overseas are pretty much the same. How do you provide adequate care and resources in a community for alcohol and drug abusers, for patients with psychological issues, behavioral problems? And when you transport them, you need to have additional resources available for the transports as well. And this article outlines some of those issues as community health issues. But I think that we also need to focus on the fact that this is one of those situations, as we look at this particular situation, and this has happened here in the States, it's happened other places, and clearly when someone is distraught and is a danger to themselves, they can also be a danger to others, and there needs to be additional providers on board, whether it's asking a police officer to ride along or asking another first responder to get in and help transport, whether that's a local fire department first response unit or perhaps another ambulance unit or a supervisor that can come along. Because really, when you have somebody in a situation like this, you don't want to be in the back of the ambulance by yourself with them. Not necessarily only because of your own safety issues, but because if they do decide to do something stupid and jump out of the back of the ambulance, you'd like to be able to try to stop them. But you know, you can get yourself in a position where you end up getting dragged out with them. If you have another person back there to help restrain them when they go to injure themselves, hopefully that will go a little bit farther, or at least prove that you were attempting to provide for that eventuality. Even if you aren't successful, you could at least make a try at saying, look, we tried. We brought an extra person on board. We made an effort to keep that person safe, and they still overpowered us and got out. You know, when someone wants to kill themselves or injure themselves, they're going to do it. And we need to be aware of that and make sure that we're not getting ourselves harmed at the same time. But we also can make additional provisions to provide care, and have another provider on board is certainly one way to do that. I'm curious to find out if you've ever had some situation like this. Maybe not somebody who's leapt out of the back of your ambulance, but in a situation where you worried about that patient and their actions and what you did to overcome that problem and that situation. Did you have somebody else ride along with you? Did you make some provision for additional restraints? You know, a lot of protocols don't allow for restraining a patient except in specific situations. And so we are not often in the position to go ahead and ask for having those restraints. That is something that a lot of medical facilities are moving away from. Putting a patient in restraints oftentimes just reinforces their view of themselves and just postpones the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. But when you're by yourself in a moving ambulance, sometimes there needs to be additional resources in place. And so restraints might be indicated, but I'd be interested to hear back from you. So this is one of those opportunities where you can get back in touch with me and let me know what your thoughts are on this. Perhaps you regularly transport psych patients, and how does your unit and facility handle those kind of things? Let me know. Contact me here by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can call in to the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. The final story today is a brief story out of EMSresponder.com, and it's about a Pennsylvania ambulance organization that has decided to move away from constantly using lights and sirens during transports. And this is one organization in Berks County, Pennsylvania, that thinks so. The Exeter Ambulance Association announced last week that its crews will no longer use lights and sirens on most of their transports and calls. You know, they've looking at statistics that we've heard about. I think a lot of us have heard about these statistics that show that using lights and sirens doesn't really do much to get us to the scene any faster. It doesn't do a lot to get us to the hospital any faster. We're talking about maybe a difference of 30 to 60 seconds in some cases, depending on your length of transport. And so lights and sirens doesn't do a lot en route to the scene or en route to a facility. It may help us on scene to direct traffic around our vehicles and alert people that there is an emergency up ahead and to slow down. Although, heck, how often do we see that they don't slow down? But certainly something to consider. So this is something that a lot of other organizations are looking to do. I'm curious because this is the first that I've seen something like this, but it's something that I wonder if this is going to be more common. The Pennsylvania Department of Health guidelines, according to this article, has statements that ambulances should not use lights and sirens while going to the hospital unless a critically injured patient is on board. And emergency personnel believe that time will be saved by traveling in emergency speeds that would actually benefit the patient. And think about it. How often do we actually have a call where seconds count? I mean, let's be honest here, really. I mean, how often is there a situation that we can't stabilize immediately with emergency care where those seconds count because of something that we can't do in the back of our ambulance? And when you start looking at it in that perspective, we probably shouldn't be driving lights and sirens hardly ever. But I'm sure we're going to get arguments and discussions about this, but I think sometimes those lights and sirens make us feel a little too invincible when we drive and make us not be appropriately careful when we drive and move through intersections. So is it really worth it for us to not obey traffic signals under lights and sirens guidelines when we don't really need to, and putting ourselves, our patients, and our partners in jeopardy? So this is going to raise a hot topic, I suspect. So you can certainly head over and send me an email, call in on the voicemail line, or even leave a message over at the Medicast forums. And, you know, that address is forums.medicast.com. But I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to jump on into this week's tip. We've got another visit from our good friend Lisa Booz over at the Maryland Poison Center. mdpoison.com is your link there, and whether you live in the state of Maryland or not, whether you're in the U.S. or not, there are a lot of great resources there, and you can sign up for their email newsletter and hear from Lisa every month with some tips on poisonings and toxicology aimed specifically at the Emergency Medical Services Response Group. So you can check that out at mdpoison.com. But we're going to be talking a little bit, since we're heading into springtime here in the U.S., about hallucinogenic plants and some of the things your patients might be doing that they think are okay and natural because they're growing in the wild, but maybe aren't necessarily as safe as they think it is to get high. And we're going to have to deal with that as we pick them up. So this is a little something to be aware of as springtime rolls in here soon. And I will leave the rest of this to Lisa and our interview we conducted earlier. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm back here with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center for another of our Tox Tidbit segments. And I'm curious to find out what Lisa has for us today. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jamie. Well, we all know, everybody out there, all of your listeners, we all know that substance abuse is a common problem in adolescents and young adults these days. We typically think of drugs of abuse as being street drugs like heroin and cocaine, or prescription drugs like the opioid analgesics, or even over-the-counter drugs containing dextromethorphan. But there's another type of substance that adolescents and young adults are commonly abusing, and they're plants. There are several plants that are abused that are considered hallucinogenic or psychoactive. And the most common plant that poison centers hear about, at least our poison center, is Jimson weed. Jimson weed grows wild throughout the U.S. and actually worldwide along roadsides and fields. And we've even seen it in vacant lots in the inner city areas. Other common names for Jimson weed are devil's weed, stink weed, loco weed, thorn apple, angel's trumpet, and devil's trumpet. The plant's pretty easy to identify. It grows to about 5 feet tall, and it has purple or white trumpet-shaped flowers. They look like morning glory flowers. And they have very prickly seed pods. Now, those seed pods have maybe about 50 to 100 small brown or black seeds inside of those pods. Poison centers typically receive calls about Jimson weed exposures in the fall when the plant reaches maturity, and so there's more of the psychoactive alkaloids or compounds in the leaves and in the seeds. The seeds or the dried leaves are ingested directly from the plant, or sometimes they're made into a tea, or sometimes the leaves are smoked to deliberately produce delirium and hallucinations. Exposures to Jimson weed produces anticholinergic effects. Jimson weed actually contains atropine and two other substances, hyoscyamine and scopolamine. They're the major alkaloids that we find in Jimson weed. And these effects will appear within 30 to 100 minutes after ingesting the seeds. It might be a little shorter, a little longer, depending on what type of preparation they're using. The effects that we see are very classic anticholinergic or atropine-like effects. So they have dilated pupils, their bowel sounds have been diminished, they have urinary retention, their skin is very dry, their mucous membranes are very dry, their skin is flushed, they're tachycardic, they have hypertension, hyperthermia, agitation, delirium, they're hallucinating, and occasionally they can have seizures. Not commonly, but that can occur. Now, most cases of Jimson weed intoxication just respond to supportive care. This is one case, however, where it might be beneficial to give activated charcoal several hours later, maybe even as long as 12 to 24 hours later, because as the drug substances in the seeds or in the leaves are absorbed, it slows down the gastric emptying and you get delayed absorption. So activated charcoal might be beneficial in a lot of these cases if they're awake and able to protect their airway. Benzodiazepines are often used for agitation in these patients. They're often hallucinating and very kind of agitated, frightened. What we want to avoid are any other drugs that have anticholinergic properties. So you do not want to give drugs like atropine, antihistamines, even Haldol. Haloperidol has some anticholinergic properties, so we want to avoid drugs like that. Physostigmine is an antidote that is given sometimes for Jimson weed exposures. It does reverse all of those anticholinergic effects, but it should be limited to very severely affected patients and preferably only with poison center consultation. There's a risk of seizures, there's a risk of bradycardia, and also dysrhythmias if too much physostigmine is given or if it's given too fast or given inappropriately. Also, physostigmine is shorter acting than the effects from the Jimson weed, and so the physostigmine will wear off before the effects of the Jimson weed will. Now, the next plant that we hear a lot about is psilocybin mushrooms. These are commonly ingested to produce hallucinations. They grow naturally in the U.S. in fields and parks and commonly in cow pastures, particularly in the Pacific Northwest and the Gulf Coast, but they can be found pretty much anywhere in an area that's highly fertilized, and that would even include lawns and athletic fields in some cases. They're also grown in clandestine mushroom farms, and you can even find in sort of drug culture or drug-oriented literature kits, mushroom-growing kits that you can purchase to buy your own. These psilocybin mushrooms are also known as magic mushrooms, shrooms, and caps, and they contain alkaloids that are much like LSD, and so the effects are pretty much the same as if someone had taken LSD. 30 minutes after eating the mushrooms, the hallucinations begin. They get a lot of sensory distortions, dilated pupils, muscle weakness. Their heart rate may go up a little bit, and they usually complain of a dry mouth. Most of these effects last for about 6 hours, and they're usually self-limiting, but sometimes people do have what we call bad trips, where they have a lot of anxiety and they're frightened, and sometimes they need some sedation and just some calming down because of those bad trips. Keep in mind, though, that sometimes mushrooms are sold on the street that actually are edible mushrooms, like we often buy in the grocery store, but they've been laced with LSD or other drugs, and so that can produce longer-lasting or even unexpected different effects than what you would see with the psilocybin mushrooms. Now, there are two emerging plants that are being abused, Salvia divinorum and kratom. Salvia is an herb in the sage family. It's also known as mystic sage and magic mint. It's native to Mexico, but it's now being cultivated in some cases here in the United States. Its effect or its hallucinogenic mechanism of action is a little bit different than any other drug. We think that it actually stimulates one specific opioid receptor. It can be chewed, It can be made into a liquid extract that's applied sublingually, but it's most commonly smoked, and it's often used along with other hallucinogens like Jimson weed or the magic mushrooms. These products are widely sold, and they're legal in most states, including our home state of Maryland. Salvia produces experiences ranging anywhere from uncontrollable laughter, which is pretty common with salvia, to very intense hallucinations and delirium. They may also experience paranoia, sweating, diuresis, incoherent speech, and a whole variety of other altered mental states. But significant toxic effects really aren't likely to occur. The duration effects is much, much shorter than other more well-known psychedelic agents. If salvia is smoked, the effects typically only last for a few minutes, and so treatment's usually not necessary. If a friend of a patient calls 911 or the friend takes the teen to the emergency department, the experiences that they're having are usually over before anyone's able to evaluate them. So treatment usually is just giving maybe a benzodiazepine like Valium or Ativan for persistent anxiety and agitation. Now, kratom is a Southeast Asian medicinal plant that's abused, but it's also being used as an alternative to more traditional medicines. The leaves of the plant have alkaloids that can produce these psychoactive properties, but it also has some dose-related effects similar to opioids, so it does have an analgesic effect, and it also has been used to relieve opioid withdrawal symptoms. It also has a stimulant effect, similar to maybe an herbal compound like yohimbine. The leaves of the plant are usually chewed to produce the effect, but sometimes it's used as a tea. It can be made into pellets to be swallowed, or less commonly, it's smoked. And 5 to 10 minutes after chewing the leaves, euphoria and nausea develop, as well as the stimulant-like effect. And then larger doses produce stupor, dizziness, tremors, very mild hallucinations possibly, and effects last about 6 hours. Overdoses really are not reported, but it can produce withdrawal symptoms when it's chronically used and then stopped. So it's much like the opioids in that respect. Now, of the four plants that I just mentioned, only Jimson weed is likely to present with any significant toxicity other than anxiety, and none of the four will be detected in a drug screen. But it's important for EMS providers, nurses, and other healthcare providers to be able to recognize these emerging and alternative forms of drugs of abuse. The local poison center is always available to help answer any questions about these and other drugs. And as always, I'd like to remind the listeners of the poison center number, which is 800-222-1222.
Lisa, thank you very much for that information, and it's interesting how inventive people can be to find something else to alter their mental status.
That's true, and you know, every year it seems like we're hearing about something new that's coming along, and Jimson weed has been around for a long time. We've seen abuse of that for a very long time, many years, but some of these newer plants are making their way into the country from other cultures that are using them, not just as an abused plant, but in a cultural way or in a therapeutic way in some other countries. But because of the sort of adverse effects or side effects, we're finding out now that they can be abused as well.
Well, Lisa, thanks a lot, and we'll look forward to your next segment.
Thanks, Jamie.
And, you know, all of these things are things that we all deal with and run into from time to time, and it's something we should be more aware of and educate ourselves about what's common in our area. So make sure you contact your own local poison control organization, Poison Center. And, again, that number here in North America is 1-800-222-1222. And let them know about your patient so that they can help you see them through. Also, it's important to remember that poison centers are valuable in helping to avoid overcrowding and overuse of 911 centers. So working closely with your local poison center can often, about 70% of the time, alleviate the need for emergency transport or transport to an emergency department at all. And that is something that is extremely valuable to preserve the resources we have for true emergencies. So working with the local poison center and others to educate your public is a great way to deal with overcrowding and overuse of 911 services. And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. We are trying to tighten things up here and keep the episodes a little bit shorter, except for those live episodes every month. And we may be still cutting those in half as well as we've done over the last several months. But in the meantime, I want to urge you to get in touch with us here. Let us know what you think about this episode or other episodes. Offer us suggestions for future topics and areas of contact. And we'll definitely look into that. You can reach us here by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line. Let us hear your voice directly, and you can do that by calling into 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is your resource there. You can also, of course, leave a comment directly on the articles at the MedicCast blog, mediccast.com/blog, and just click the comments link at the bottom of each of the entries, and you can leave a direct comment there that's available for the other listeners to take a look at as well. So it's a great way to share and start conversations with each other. Of course, if you want to get a response from other listeners or help respond back to their questions, there's no better place than the MedicCast forums. Forums.mediccast.com, a great place to share video, pictures, and keep in touch with each other in the MedicCast community. Share your questions and comments and help each other out. That's what it's all there for, and you can find all of that at forums.mediccast.com. Time to close out the show. I will close out this show, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This week, we'll close out with a piece from our friend of the show and somebody we've played here before, Johanna Staley. And this is her song, Nothing I Would Change About You. If you like what you hear, I'd urge you to head over and check out the links in the show notes for her music. And if you want to, there's even a link there that'll take you to the iTunes store directly, and you can purchase her songs if you like them enough. And I think it's good to support these artists. So make sure you do go over and do those kind of things and show them that you heard their songs here on shows like The MedicCast. That's it for me. I will be back Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern time at MedicCastLive.com for our live show on college-based EMS services. I'm looking forward to hearing from all of you there. Come in and participate in the chat room or call in on the phone lines. MedicCastLive.com, Tuesday night, March 10th, 10 p.m. Eastern time. Until then, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you to remember, scene safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Johanna Staley, and you're about to listen to some music from my CD, I'm Not Perfect. I want to thank you guys for making such a difference. Keep up the good work.